What did you say?
The ambassadors are Jedi Knights, I believe.
I knew it. They're here to force a settlement.
Distract them. I will contact Lord Sidious.
Are you brain dead? I'm not going in there with two Jedi. Send a droid.
What did you say?
The ambassadors are Jedi Knights, I believe.
I knew it. They're here to force a settlement.
Distract them. I will contact Lord Sidious.
I'm not going in there with two Jedi. Send a droid.
I need an analysis of this blood sample I'm sending you.
Wait a minute.
I need a midichlorian count.
The reading's off the chart. Over 20,000.
Even Master Yoda doesn't have a midichlorian count that high.
No Jedi has.
What does that mean?
I'm not sure. I need an analysis of this blood sample I'm sending you.
Wait a minute. The reading's off the chart. What does that mean?
I'm not sure.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.
Welcome, everybody, to another fun-filled episode of the Hollywood Saloon. I'm Andy, and with me, of course, is that human film database, Mr. John Jansen.
Hello, welcome. Welcome all.
And we're going to look at something very interesting today, and you've all heard about it to a certain extent. We're going to dig into it a little deeper here. And
it's sort of an exploration of our outtakes from one of our Final Cut.
Yeah, exactly. This could kind of be a companion piece to the Final Cut.
Like we decided to make a feature film out of our outtake.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, there's all this extra stuff to talk about, which fits in perfectly with this topic. And what we're talking about today is what we're calling the fan edit, okay? Now, what we're talking about here is, and I know a lot of you have heard of the Phantom re-edit, or what do they call it, the Phantom edit?
That was the Phantom edit
the
in
Phantom
1999.
Edit. Right.
And I guess you could sort of trace a history back to that moment to where it became, I don't know, I mean, it made something like Entertainment Weekly in terms of notoriety. And I guess it was at the right time because the web, World Wide Web, was just starting to bloom.
Right.
Wide enough for something like that to really make an impact. And for anybody out there that doesn't know what we're talking about, in 1999, George Lucas put out a film called Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. It was met with mixed results, to put it kindly.
Right. Yeah.
And one fan was so incised that he took the film and re-edited it to more his liking and posted it out there free for anybody that wanted to download it or see it or trade it. I think it probably became a staple at some conventions and that kind of sort.
Right.
And he basically went in and, I mean, I remember seeing it, you know, through somebody else that owned a copy. So I vaguely remember it. But my first instinct was, is he's not going far enough. He could go farther. This is good, but, you know, there's more that you could do if you really tried to go in there and creatively rethink it, like as an editor, someone that hasn't lived with the film for a long time and can kind of take a fresh approach to it and say, well, let's just change the sensibilities a little bit. Let's change the aim from trying to make it down to a 7-year-old and just bring it up to general audience.
Right. Well, and that's the basic idea. We're going to hop onto to more of those exact type of cuts in a minute. But I think the basic idea that we're talking about is really exemplified there with the Phantom edit, is that we're talking about, you know, fans, us filmmakers, going in, you know, now that we basically all can afford editing equipment, You know,
an important thing to a distinction to make is this person could do it in Final Cut Pro or Premiere,
sure,
or Avid very easily.
Oh, absolutely. Well, like I said, since it's so readily available now, and the cost is really, it's not an issue anymore. It's not like in the days when we were learning how, where you had to have, you know, these big massive decks.
Well, it was, first of all, you had to dump the whole movie down on tape,
right?
Which means you're already losing a generation,
right?
And then you put that in your play deck, but then you put your blankets. You're going down another generation for whatever your edit's going to be.
and then if you want to make a copy for somebody off your master,
which means a whole other generation,
right,
from
well,
that.
Well, and besides that, you're cutting linearly in that you have to go from A to Z.
Right. But in a way, you're training yourself as an editor. You're thinking that cut, and you're rewatching it three or four times. And when you move on from that cut, you're not going to change your mind.
Yeah.
And when you have to edit with those type of restraints, I think it forces you to learn how to edit stronger in your head.
Oh, sure.
Sort of foresee cuts before you actually get to them. And then if you started out that way, when you move into digital, suddenly it's like, well, wait a second, I'm four cuts ahead anyway, so now digital's as fast as I can think.
Well, that's the blessing of kind of how you and I learned how to edit on, you know, either talking about flatbed with 16mm film or... Mm-hmm. on VHS video, was that we had to think that way. And I think it really, you know, built us as stronger editors. But so now that when we get to the digital age where it's nonlinear and you can go, you know, I can start on minute one. And if I get tired of that, I can jump to the end and work on the end, you know, or
right.
I can make a change really simply, just jump in there and, you know, because my timeline can pull it all across. You know, really, the editing on the timeline has changed everything. And I think that, you know, having that training for us helped us understand editing a little more. And I kind of feel for you guys who never had that opportunity to go in there and learn it the old-fashioned way. I mean, I would hate to go back and do that now. I mean, I'd pull my hair out, you know, and I mean, whatever hair I have left, you know. Used to make a joke that, you know, I lost my hair because, you know, I'm getting kind of chrome-domed on the top there, is that, you know, I lost it being an editor the old-fashioned way, you know.
Well, this reminds me of sort of what I consider almost an origin of a fan edit, or at least an offshoot of it, is when you and I were both in school, something you and I, a combined interest was taking footage from a movie and recutting it to a song.
Right, exactly.
As an editing exercise.
Great exercise.
You know, whether you're trying to do something abstract that absolutely, you know, doesn't have a desire to tell the story or anything, and just using imagery, or... like what we did with, well, what you did in the Aliens one and sort of, you know, with the Highlander one, is trying to tell the story of the movie like an extended trailer, but pick a song that's not related to the movie.
Right.
And see if, you know, what the clash is like. The mashups today, I think, is almost an evolution out of that kind of idea.
Well, and you get those, they've got them all over the place on YouTube now. You can get them, you know, just, they're really simple to look it up. You just type in the movie and, you know, re-edit or something like that, and
right.
They're all over the list. Most of them are horrible and hideous. But I mean, you know, I mean, if it, this is
we
these...
had that with the Brokeback. Remember those? There's like
yeah,
the 27th Brokeback parody that came out that day.
Exactly. So yeah, I think that's a pretty common thing now. Is whether it's a learning exercise, you're making an extended trailer of your own, or like you said, the parodies. I think that what you're seeing is people using this stock raw footage as a means to do an exercise to create something else. And I mean, that's the nice thing about a film, is that you have that raw footage. Now, when you extend that into, however, you know, a feature-length film, that's a different situation, because you're talking about minutiae. I mean, you can't, unless you have a wealth of deleted scenes you're adding back into the film, there's not a lot of things to pull from. I mean,
well,
you're mostly trimming.
Ask yourself, what's my agenda?
Mm-hmm.
What's the goal here? Why does this film need re-editing? That's the first question
sure.
you ask.
Sure.
And, you know, what do I want to try to get out of it? You mean the first fan edit that I ever put together, and we talked about this on the Final Cut show, but was The Close Encounters of the Third Kind, because the Criterion Laserdisc had both the original and the special edition, and you could branch it. So what I did is I programmed it to where all the scenes from both versions would play.
Mm-hmm.
So I made myself an extended version, and I put it on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, hey, I have this unique cut of Close Encounters, because my attitude was, well, I like all the scenes. So when I want to watch Close Encounters, I want the whole thing. So that was sort of my first exposure of the idea of trying to do that just as a fan of a movie to have an extended version. And I know that the same idea carried over to the Superman movies. If you go to SupermanCinema.com, several years ago started a project for fans of Superman 1 and Superman 2. As we talked about in previous shows in the Final Cut, both of those films had extended versions when they aired on television. Specifically, the first time they aired, and then other times they aired, there might not be as many scenes as the first broadcast showing. But what they did is they combed everyone around the world that was a member of this club, and they submitted their best materials to combine together to make the ultimate long cut of Superman 1 based on every available footage that had been made available to the public, either through any, like a European TV broadcast that was different from the American broadcast, from the Australian one, and they combined it all together, and they put out, you know, a four-disc set, you know, two discs for each movie, Superman 1 and 2, with the longest possible version. I mean, it has Superman racing the Concorde on the way to Paris for Superman 2. That was only seen on the television version.
Right.
And it's not even a deleted scene on either one of the Superman 2 discs on this new deluxe box set. So there you go. If you want it, you want to see it, this was the only way you were going to get to. And, I mean, this is a complete fan-driven project. Mm-hmm. This is coming out of the love of everyone sort of wanting to donate their best sources to make the best type of film. I've only seen this type of thing in the bootleg culture for bands. Like, if you're a fan of Pink Floyd, there's a lot of people out there that have gone out and found old Super 8 movies that were shot of the band in 77 and 75. And they've painstakingly found the audio recordings from that same show and synced them up. So these Super 8 movies, you know, even though they're only 3.5 minutes, you know, can play out. And then they'll add still frames and other elements to sort of, you know, carry out the song.
Yeah.
And it's completely traded freely within, you know, fans of Pink Floyd. They don't sell them. They're just all traded among.
Right.
Immaculate Productions. That kind of fandom is only, you know, is now, I think, being carried over into movies.
Sure.
To where we're starting to see that same type of creativity going into the creation of these new alternate cuts. Now, fan cuts. I mean, is that how we're dubbing it?
Fan cuts, fan edits. I mean, I think either one really, really fits. I think that, I mean, you have to really look at it. I mean, if you explain it in the same terms of what you said with the Pink Floyd bootleg situation, and as an exercise, I think this is a great thing, you know? And this is, I mean, what an educational tool, you know, to be able to go in there and rework a film and turn it into something different. Like I said, you've got this wealth of raw footage to be able to use. I mean, and like I said, we've talked about this before, and you know that I've got issues with, you know, the actual idea behind the fan edit, because I really, I mean, and I don't know if you want to jump into this right now, but I can tell you that I have an issue with someone recutting someone else's, you know, art, for lack of a better term, because I think art is relative. You know, one person, you know, if you recut the Phantom Menace, one person may like it, while another person is totally offended by that and say, you know, you've changed this, you've changed that, you've cut content, you've cut. You know, or they might be upset by the fact that Jar Jar's gone. Now, if for the editor, as an exercise, I've got no problem with that. And I also really don't have a problem with someone putting it out on the internet and saying, this is my little exercise that I have done. See if this interests you or not. Because ultimately, I mean, if 1,000 editors did this, there could be 1,000 different versions of The Phantom Menace. And so that's fine as long as it's labeled, you know, this cut or that cut. What I don't like is when someone comes out and says, you know, this is what Phantom Menace should be like. You know what
Has
I mean?
Has anyone
this
done is, that? I mean, is there an example of that that you know
well,
of?
Well, I know that with the Phantom edit, there's been discussion of that before. I think it's such an easy target to hit the Phantom Menace. And, you know, I'm no Kool-Aid drinker for the Phantom Menace. Sure, I'm a Star Wars spinner, as we all know. But you know, I know that it's not a perfect gem, and there's issues, especially with all the Jar Jar crap. So, but I think the problem with me is that, like I said, it's all relative to one individual person, you know, because it is someone's art. You know, just because we don't think that The Phantom Menace is the best Star Wars doesn't mean that someone else doesn't. You know, and it's hard for us to say, you know, we can be the judge of this, we can be the judge of that. I think it's a little pompous, it's a little arrogant to say, oh, I'm going to recut George Lucas and I have the right to do so. Well, as a fan, as an exercise, of course you do. And, I mean, no one's going to stop you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there could very well be the possibility, depending on each person's abilities, that they could do something very, you know, worthy. You know, and we'll get to that later because you did a Phantom redo edit that
I've
done
a few of them actually.
Well, and I think that, you know, and I've seen it now, most of it, and I think it's for the most part fantastic. As an edit, I think it's great. And like I said, we'll get into the details of it later. But I think that, you know, as an idea, if you came up and said, "Well, this is the better version," and you know, I've recut Lucas, and Lucas needs to, you know, Lucas is an ass and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you can't
do that. That's the thing is, I mean, the person that comes out with that attitude is the ass.
Yeah.
Because that's the wrong attitude to take. Because, first of all, to undertake any type of project like this, you have got to really admire and respect the artist at hand. I mean, it's like a band that you really like. And you say, hey, that's a good version of the song, but boy, if I could get on the knobs and remix it a certain way...
Yeah, well, it's like a remix.
I could remix this song to my tastes more. And we talked about that in music. A lot of bands that I like, U2 specifically, does remixes of their songs, and I like the remixes better often than the original ones.
And I think
but
that's
they don't
cool.
replace it, and I think that's always cool. There's a room for that.
Sure.
You know, much like how we're seeing with these alternate cuts by directors. Those are remixes, in a sense.
Right.
If both cut exists, like Almost Famous is a remix, although it's really the original cut, untitled. But, I mean, you can say it like that. This new Miami Vice Director's Extended Edition is a remix of Miami Vice cut.
But Michael Mann was the force behind both of those edits.
It was, you know, he talks about it on the commentary.
Right.
It was 2 months after theatrical. He'd lived with the film a little bit longer, breathed, and reassessed the film's priorities, and went back and applied the cut.
Well, but listen, what we're talking about is just the director's cut. I mean, we've already set that down in stone in the final cut, is that we're cool with the director's cut as long as they give us the option of both. I mean, I don't really consider that. Well, I wouldn't even consider that a remix. That's just a director's cut.
Well, it's a director's remix, but the point I wanted to make was in the Star Wars Episode I documentary, The Beginning, there's a moment, the camera captured it, it's really worth watching the documentary for, of when Lucas and his editor and everybody is sitting down and they're watching the movie, and they know that it's locked. That's it.
Right.
They can't do any more. And there's a look on Lucas's face, and there's a look on other people's face in there, and they know they're locked into their release date. If their release date was pushed back by 6 months, Phantom Menace would be a completely different movie than the one that came out that day. Yeah. If their release date was pushed back a year, who knows
what
whims of fancy he would have had by tweaking it and looking at it, going on vacation for 2 months, coming back, looking at it again. I mean, there's just a difference when you're rushing to get a film out.
Well,
now, he did revisit it for the DVD. And he did add in some smaller little things, but it wasn't really a massive re-edit.
Well, I think, and we've also stated that the real enemy of a film being its top quality is this release date set in stone. You know what I mean? That's the thing that gives you Miami Vice, the theatrical edition, when there's going to be a Miami Vice director's cut coming out.
Yeah, if Miami Vice was due to come out in November, this would have been the version that came out all along. We never would have seen the theatrical.
Well, see, and here's my problem with that, is that I wasted my time and my money and my virgin vision going to see this film when, okay, here we are again. Now, and we knew that Michael Mann was going to do this. You know, we even said
it. And this is the idea of, oh, there's a new radio remix of that song that you liked over the summer. And guess what? It's like the remix of Shout by Tears for Fears.
Right.
I always liked it better than the album version.
Well,
hey, I'm a fan of the remix of Shout, and I came out second.
Right.
But it's like, hey, you know, this is even better. So now
that's fine. But listening to a 3-minute song is different than watching a 2-hour film.
Well, you see the analogy I'm trying to make.
No, I know.
I'm spinning it a little.
No, I think the analogy is strong. And you know, we've stated the director's cuts are a thing, and we're used to it, and we can expect it. And
wouldn't you agree that Lucas would have probably made more changes had he lived with the film a little bit longer?
That's possible, yeah.
Specifically a film that's so animated-driven, like Phantom Menace was. Like, right. You can't really change a lot because a lot of things are locked down.
Sure.
But again, I mean, who's to say? You know, Lucas is a brilliant editor. That's not in question. But I think in what you're talking about, the exercise of... Yeah. I mean, think about what happened recently with this new Beatles album, Love. Cirque du Soleil?
Cirque du Soleil, right.
Cirque du Soleil. They created a show, and George Martin was asked to come back in and create a soundscape. He had 78 minutes. They needed about 80 minutes worth of music.
Right.
He could pick whatever he wanted. And I guess they were working with the directors on certain songs and whatnot. But the idea was to do a mashup of Beatles, combining two or three songs, going through the master tapes, pulling out outtakes, a vocal outtake here, a guitar outtake, or a different bass line, and mixing it all together to create one continuous soundscape. It's a Beatles remix album, essentially. But it's mashed in a way that almost makes it new and fresh for someone that's never even heard the Beatles before.
Right.
It can be quite exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's not even necessarily greatest hits, but it certainly shows the diversity of what the Beatles did.
Well, it probably lends itself really well to Cirque du Soleil, and those are pretty popular. And I've been to two of them, maybe three. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see how that would definitely work for that type of environment.
And George Martin, of course, is the guy. He knows their music better than anybody. I mean, he is the fifth Beatle.
Right.
So for him to go in there and play around with the tracks, you know, is very exciting. On the other hand, it would also be exciting if, you know, whoever had the ability to go in there. I mean, who knows what you could do when the material is that good to start with.
Well, obviously they wanted to be reverential to what came before because, I mean, they could have asked, you know, Puff Daddy to come in there and remix the Beatles.
Oh, I love that was the concept. No new recordings.
Yeah.
What's cool is they take like two different Ringo tracks and they throw those two drum tracks together and it creates a really thick modern sound.
Right.
But yet it's just, you know, two different songs he recorded. But I know there's a lot of creative work on that session. Or sessions, however long it took them to put together. But I like this idea and I think it continues on to where, well, obviously in the fan edit, they don't have access to all the original materials. I mean, the ultimate phantom edit would be if someone could actually go in and have access to all the same material Ben Burton had, right?
Well, see, that's the ultimate knock against the fan edit is that you can take away, but you can't add.
Oh, right.
You know, you can add some deleted scenes, like I said, but for the most part, if you're trying to smooth out a scene, let's just take, for example, some of the stuff you did in your Phantom Redo edit with taking a Jar Jar piece out. You can take a Jar Jar out, but you can't necessarily put something else in there to smooth it over. You're just taking out, and you're trying to find the best way to fuse that scene back together. An example is when, you know, we go into the Watto shop, and you do your best to take out all the stupid Jar Jar antics. And you did really good because, most of all, it was really smoothed over and you don't notice it. And it just takes away all that ridiculousness and makes it, you know, at least the first half of it makes it feel like an actual original Star Wars story as opposed to this stupid thing. Because, I mean, really, that was the thing that killed Phantom Menace, was that you'd see something really awesome and then Jar Jar would pull some stupid shit. And you would be so confused and so twisted in your head, you'd be like going, oh, how should I feel about this? Okay, it's a Star Wars movie, but if this would have been in any other movie, I would have been throwing monkey shit at the screen. You know?
Even some of the line readings from the Nemodians very early on.
Yeah.
It's questionable on how quality it really is. And then the second question is do I really need it? What if you cut that line altogether?
Right.
Can I still get what I need out of the scene? And I think 9 times out of 10, the answer is yeah. You really don't need some of this extraneous, questionable line readings, you know?
Sure.
And so much of it is exposition to where what they're saying is what you're seeing on the screen.
Well,
it's almost like it's dialogue written for the 6-year-old right. That's really unsure.
Well, we don't need to see, what are you, brain dead? You know, I mean, that's just, it's not essential. You
when
can you, get the
when
same
When you take
idea
that
across.
Line out and you watch that scene, it's like, okay, that's fine.
Yeah,
it's like a bad note at the end of that.
Well, and one of the other ones that really got me was I always hated when the Nemoidians were sitting around the table talking to Palpatine or Lord Darth Sidious, okay? And then he introduces Darth Maul. This is my apprentice, Darth Maul. And it's like it's such a stupid monkey shit moment. You know, that's a new term I'm going to coin tonight, okay? A monkey shit moment, you know, when you throw monkey shit at the screen, okay? Where it's like, you know, it's the whole deal with Lando pulling down his mask in Return of the Jedi. It's done specifically for the audience at home, breaking that fourth wall. We didn't need to hear, this is my assistant, Darth Maul, and cut to a close-up. It's like, okay, and thanks for that introduction, you know? It's just like, come on. It doesn't matter what his frickin' name is. It just matters that he's your apprentice, and he's going to take care of business.
Yeah.
You know?
I never liked the pose that Ray Park does.
No,
you know?
It's corny.
It's just not good.
It's corny. So the way that you handled that, though, I mean, there's a little jog in there, but the way that you handled it is pretty damn smooth, and I applaud you for it. But that's the basic idea, is that, you know, what we're really talking about here is it's almost not like a fan edit. It's a fan delete. You know what I mean?
It's a fan remix is really the fair thing.
Well, it's a remix.
It's going to be my interpretation of what I'm going to delete.
But the main thing is that you're extracting rather than putting in for the most part because you don't have a pool of raw footage to pull from.
All right. All I have is the deleted scenes, which
correct.
I put some of them back in.
Yeah, but that's not going to help you. Let's say that scene with the Darth Maul introduction. They shot it six different ways.
No, the key term you're looking for is the L cuts. And I don't have the cutaway shot to throw those other two lines of dialogue together to where you can, you know, extract a scene.
Sure.
And then smoothly go from one dialogue line to another, but you got to have that cutaway.
Right.
Without those cutaways, you either have to repeat a shot, which I did do in some scenes.
Well, I think you handled it quite well with what you had. But my point, like I said, in all this is that rather there's not much addition that's going on other than big blocks of deleted scenes. It's mostly extraction. And if any movie needed, I mean, that's really what you need in The Phantom Menace. You don't need to add anything. I mean, the whole kitchen sink's in there. It's all on screen. Yeah. It's you know, a bonanza of visual imagery. It's fantastic. But what it needs is all the stupid shit pulled out and to make it more friendly to you and me as an adult.
As an editor, I use, well, and I say this as kind as I can, a cringe meter.
Right.
I hit play. And every time a cringe moment came, I said, okay, I got to evaluate a cut here. What can I do? And, you know, there was really about 150 cringe moments in that movie, 200. I cataloged a lot.
Any poo-doo
jokes.
Some
of them are really minor. But, you know, they just, it's like, okay, well, if I can smooth over that and I don't need it, great. If you have to have it, then you got to live with it.
Right.
And that's sort of the experiment. But I will give you this. I learned so much, not only about that movie, but about editing and editing choices by going through that film. Almost frame for frame, not really, but you know, scene for scene specifically. I studied every single cut made in that movie and the choices made. And it's interesting because, you know, you develop a certain amount of confidence. You're going, well, it's not that this is better, but what if you tried this? What do you think? Is sort of my attitude.
Well, again,
how do you think this version plays? It's like you could cut it 3, 5, 8 different ways.
10,000 different ways.
This is just another alternate way. What do you think? It is sort of that fan. / student in you.
Well, sure.
That's you're trying to learn your craft and using somebody else's footage sort of play with.
I think it's a great exercise. The only thing that I would say against it is that, like I said, it's a fan delete. You're not pulling from raw footage. You know, the wealth of footage or the ability to create footage like Lucas did, it's a whole different story.
Well, the one thing I can do is I can reassess. Some of the editing pattern choices he made, specifically in the final battle, and the way he crisscrosses between the four lines of action.
Right.
That was something I did radically want to change, because I always had a problem with when Obi-Wan gets trapped in that long gap when it goes away, and then it kind of comes back, and then it's shifting from tragedy to slapstick humor and back and forth. And I always thought that if you reassess all of that together and just pushed a couple of them together, like, you know, when young Anakin goes inside well, the future Death Star, but whatever. That's the the station out in space.
Yeah, and then he sits
and
on that pad.
And he sort of stalls there, right?
Right.
Well, we cut away from that for almost 6 to 7 minutes before we come back.
Yeah, and those droids are still running at him.
And they're running. That's a long time to be away from that action beat. It's unrealistic. To me, I say, let's button those two scenes together. You know, and let's continue that through line of action. He goes in there, they come, he click, 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 clicks, boom, he fires, and then he's boom, he flies out of there. Then we cut to the action scene it wanted to go away from.
No,
you know?
No, I think that worked. I liked my assessment of that is the way you put that together is that I think it made a lot more sense for that exact thing you're talking about. There's these big gaps. And
I liked trapping Obi-Wan, so while he's trapped in there, now I can cut away to a space battle for 6 minutes, because we don't know how long those little things, are.
And let me just get real detailed on two issues that I did like about that. Number one of the most egregious, sickening things in Phantom Menace was right when Qui-Gon gets, you know, the lightsaber in the gut, and then we immediately go to, my give up, you know, and we go to a Jar Jar comedy scene. It totally negates and destroys all the emotions and the feelings you have about losing Qui-Gon. I mean, and, you know, by rejuxtapositioning everything like you've done, you've destroyed that moment, thank God, because that moment, it takes for granted the fact that we just saw, you know, basically the main character of this film murdered. And the power of it, you know?
It would be like when Ben dies, we cut away to some slapstick robot humor.
Right.
Like him being tortured or something.
And so, number one, taking that one out was fantastic. That's just, whew, I wish George Lucas would do that. And the other one was my favorite, and it's kind of trivial, was, you know, after Obi-Wan flies up and does the flip around and then slashes Darth Maul in half, is there's always that little beat where he stares at Darth Maul for a second.
It's an odd beat. It feels like forever.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's like what? 6 frames, 8 frames or something?
Yeah, like 12 frames.
Yeah, something like that. It's not that much, but it's enough to say, okay, the pause on that makes me believe that Darth Maul is badass enough that he could have stuck, you know, his lightsaber shiv through Obi-Wan while he's standing there staring at him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you nip that stuff out, didn't miss it a bit, and it's more like, it's like kung fu or something. It's like whack, you know, it's quick. And I can see, it's like, no, Darth Maul could not defend against that.
When I was also trying to play with when Obi-Wan was hanging over the edge and Maul was looking at him and the lightsaber starts shifting, mm-hmm. I was trying to play Sergio Leone and go like lightsaber, Maul, Obi-Wan, lightsaber, well. Obi-Wan, Maul. And I just didn't have enough footage to play with, you know what I mean? But had I had the raw footage, I think you could have drawn that out editorially kind of interestingly. Not that Star Wars movies are supposed to do that, but again, that's the student in me. That's breaking the laws a little bit.
I mean, to me, when I saw that was just you having fun.
Exactly.
I mean, this is your exercise, there's nothing wrong with that. That's a blast. There's a difference between having fun like you were there and trimming those 12 frames out of the slash, because that changes content. That changes the beat, because you don't buy the Darth Maul wouldn't wipe him out. Okay,
right.
Now you fix that. That's a different. That's an edit as opposed to having editing fun on the other side, you know, and playing with stuff. That's a whole different situation, you know. One of the other things I'm going to say, and one thing I learned from watching your Phantom Redo edit was how much I think we should do a commentary for the Phantom Menace and really get down and talk about all this. And I don't want this episode to become another freaking Star Wars episode.
No.
So
we got Superman to get to.
We'll blow past this, but one more thing I did want to mention is that the only thing I don't like is when you go in and you mess with Star Wars canon. You mess with content, okay?
Oh, right.
You mess with style, that's one thing.
I think I was trying to tell you, again, this is not designed to replace Phantom Menace. This is designed for someone that's seen Phantom Menace 5 times, knows the content inside and out, okay? But kind of like, doesn't enjoy watching it the same way anymore. It's kind of like over the Phantom Menace. Well, here's like the new for 2000 whatever edition. A little bit remixed, jazzed up. It's got some new scenes in it. We trim back some of the other antics to try and give you a new experience of the same film.
No, I'm cool with that.
You already know that the midichlorians are there, and you already know about all the canon stuff. So almost like a television edit, we're going to breeze through some of it.
But hold on.
Not annoy you with some of the lesser things. You know?
I'm a big fan of how Obi-Wan explains the Force in episode 4. I have no problem with that. I don't need the midichlorians. I've never been a fan of the midichlorians. However, two things that you took out of this that are content that I think have a bearing on the film are, number one, midichlorians altogether. You took that all out of the scene where he sends the blood sample to Obi-Wan.
Well, no, the blood sample's still there. It's just
No, the blood sample's there, but there's no mention of midichlorians.
I just took the word midichlorians out of it.
And there's no mention. You say the levels are off the charts. There's
right.
no mention.
You just
of,
don't know what they're talking
there's
about.
There's no mention of, you know, the number of them.
I thought it would be interesting to keep it a mystery.
Well, but there's no mention also of it being higher than Master Yoda's.
I didn't. Yeah, I took that line out.
And to me, that bugged me because that shows me the severity. Now, granted, let me give you this. Is that if I'm really watching The Phantom Menace for the first time, I should know who the hell Yoda really is at that point in the film anyways. Okay? But if they...
You're right, because he hadn't even been introduced. You're saying
correct.
That name Yoda has no reference.
Correct. There's no
good,
Yoda
see?
Reference. But we
You're
would,
a good editor.
But we would learn later who Yoda is, and it would at least set a bar, saying,
right.
well, Yoda is the highest we've got, and he's higher than Yoda. Okay? See, I'm cool with that. So my problem is taking that out, you take away the severity of what kind of power we're dealing with.
I'm not
with
disagreeing.
Here.
I thought that you could almost get the same thing. It's like, wow, he's got really high charts. Don't know what that means. Could be good or bad.
No, I know, but they do know what it means. That means if your midichlorians are higher than Master Yoda's, you're coming with.
I'm not going to disagree. You know, I mean, you make choices and you move on. And
if they're not, and it's just regular old midichlorians, well, maybe you'll come, maybe not. Maybe you're too old for the training.
You know what's so great as an editor? I don't feel so bad because even my hero who edited the first version of this, you know, he made some choices that weren't so great too.
Well,
so.
Of course.
I'm in good company.
Like I said, I'm not knocking your independent exercise choices. I'm
right.
just talking about...
No, it could never
here.
Become canon or replace canon.
Oh, of course not.
I mean,
of
it would
course
never
not.
Do that. It's,
of course
it's
not.
Almost
but
like...
You know what? In watching your exercise, I'm joyful of the trims you've made, but when you've gotten into content, then I'm pulled out of the moment just as bad as I am while watching Jar Jar doing his fucking antics.
So basically, if I put like two or three things back in and that was the cut, you might be just fine with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there you go. You could easily be done.
Right. And then you also took away the... Who's the father?
I did take away that.
And you know what? That's a beat that isn't really brought up again until Sith, when they're sitting there and the whole conversation with, you know, Darth.
Right.
What was his name?
It's alluded to very cleverly, but it's never on the
Right,
nose.
Right. And that I like.
I do like that. It's a well-acted
and so
scene.
That's another...
I didn't like the mother's delivery on it. And I thought, well... You know, why put the note here if it's not a strong note? How does it play without the note? And so I took it out and
right.
watched the scene
but
two
you know
or three times without
but
it.
You know
and I went, well, since I already have this knowledge in my head for this version, let's just move it along.
Well, but you know what's a clanging moment to me is in that same scene with Qui-Gon and Shmi is when his last line is, well, I didn't actually come here to free slaves.
Yeah.
I always hated that line. It's like, you dirty slave. I didn't come here to free you, you dirty slave. I mean, that's the line to me that needs to be shot because it's different than Qui-Gon's character. Qui-Gon is like a gentleman knight to me. You know, he's like the ultimate. I mean, I truly believe that had Qui-Gon made it through and not been killed, that the Empire would have never been born.
There you go.
So I mean,
had to happen.
You know what I mean? But we're talking Star Wars here. Let's get back onto the fan edit.
Well, I was going to say, did you also notice like some of the trends when he's saying goodbye to his mother, and instead of like, you know, what does your heart tell you? And I cut all that other stuff. I don't know. And I just got to, I will come back and save you.
No, that's great.
See, I think, you know, when you take out the uncertainty and you give that confidence in there, it's like you can hint a little bit at that early age.
Jake Lloyd's performance is so weak that it's almost like you need to cut every line out that he does in the whole film.
So when you take out, you know, say 40% of his dialogue in the movie, 50, you know, 45%, it changes his performance
yeah.
in a way. You know, it's like it's passable in a different kind of way.
We fix your performance by cutting all your stuff out.
Do you know how many times? I mean, that's an editor's job. Do you know how many great actors that you and I love have been fixed in the editing?
Oh, sure.
All of them, you know? I mean, let's don't be coy about it. I mean, there's been many a performance. I mean, great performances have been created in editing.
Well, sure.
I mean, I think that's kind of what we're talking. I mean, the gift of editing is being able to sort of, you know, it's that magic.
That's the difference between stage and film is that, you know, with stage you get one shot. With film you get 62.
Yeah.
If you're working with Stanley Kubrick, and then he's going to use, and then he's going to use a piece from here and a piece from there and a piece from here and make your performance fantastic. Hey, you know what? Let's not lie. Editing saves the Hollywood Saloon too.
Oh, absolutely.
All the all the you knows that I take out that people don't have to go through. You know. So
you know, I do know.
And we still have you knows in there that we don't take out, just so that the flow isn't disrupted. But I think I think the basic idea is that
you can see where I was coming at.
Oh, no,
you
know, I know where you're coming from.
It was almost like my thesis was, can you not make, I don't know, not say Phantom Menace better, but is there a way to go in there and change the tone of the movie to where it was like less aimed at a 7-year-old and more aimed at the same level I remember Star Wars kind of felt.
Oh, no, and you know what? I think you were very successful. My problem was with this cut here, that cut here, this content issue there. I mean, there's nothing that's, and plus you have to understand that I'm pinging off of what I know. I mean, I know every edit on the Phantom Menace.
Well, it's designed for someone like you, because like I said, there's 200 changes in there.
Well, no, but for someone else who doesn't know shots, I mean, you and I, and a lot of our listeners know shot for shot for shot. If you change one shot in the movie, I'm going to know it.
They're going to notice. I know. That's why you think it's great.
Well, and there's some people
You're the perfect audience.
Right, and there's some hardcore, intense fans and filmmakers who will notice those things. But there's others who won't, and it'll be just fine. And I think that your film, your edit will work. I mean, I almost wish I could make that the official edit. And I'll tell you one thing. I'm going to put it in my Phantom Menace box. So that's a a tip of the hat to you. It will never replace the original because the original is George Lucas's vision. And I want to have what he intended for me to see.
I want the next one that's coming out with the digital Yoda.
Oh, yeah,
so
absolutely.
Screw the one that we have.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know,
but maybe when the digital Yoda comes back, I'll do a Phantom edit redo and address your concerns, and then you can have an ultimate cut.
I'll have the ultimate Andy cut.
Because that's almost what it comes down to. You're customizing it to your taste.
Sure.
It's like I gave it to a friend of mine, and he was like, can you cut out C-3PO altogether? And it's like he had a list of things that he wanted, you know, in there. It's like it didn't even go far enough for him. And everyone's going to be like that. There's no way I can score 100 on this.
Well, you know,
if I can score 93 or 95, I'm happy.
Of course you can't. I mean, it's to your taste. And I mean, ultimately, I mean, and you're starting to see that now. And I mean, do you remember the Final Destination 3 disc that came out? It had, you know, design your own edit.
Right.
Who's going to die next or all this kind of stuff. And it was all branching. See, this interactivity is going to happen.
Well, jump ahead 10 years after a generation of kids have been editing for a decade.
Right.
Look at what you're going to be seeing then. It's going to be insane because it's going to be instant downloads.
Yeah.
And forget copyright infringement. You're going to get so many mashups and redos and remixes.
Sure.
I mean, one I want to point out just rolling right along is the Never Say Never Again Special Edition remix.
Oh, God. Sound the alarm.
Sorry. Get that McClory alarm. Sorry, you're right. Call the lawyers.
Damn, how many shows can we make it without the McClory alarm?
I think some fans are waiting for it anyway. It's like the running gag. It's like, do you think they'll do it?
You think they'll do the McClory alarm again? God dang it, they did it.
Now, this guy, I champion him. This is like my kind of hero in terms of a fan editor out there.
Now, this is the guy who did the re-edit of Never Say Never Again.
Never Say Never Again. I mean, he acknowledges, like the rest of us already know, it's not a very good movie.
Sure.
And one of the worst things about it is its score, the music. And because it wasn't allowed to use any of the canon Monty Norman, James Bond theme, and any of the John Barry-like themes, it was sort of on its own, and it does not help the film at all.
Mm-hmm.
And what this guy did is he tried to turn Never Say Never Again into more of a Bond canon-like film. So he basically created his own opening Maurice Bender-like credit sequence. Mm-hmm. So it would have one of those.
Oh, but he used mostly what he did was he used images from Thunderball.
Right, right. And then he took an outtake song and used that. And then what he did is he picked the best of John Barry and David Arnold and other Bond composers, and he rescored the movie. Now, in areas where there were sound effects, he redid the Foley.
Yeah.
And it's a different experience to watch the movie. Now, no, it doesn't suddenly make that movie great, but when you're a fan of Bond and fan of Connery, when he comes around the corner and you hear that Bond theme, it's like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's the fan in you that wants to hear that music, or it wants that movie to be better. You already know it's not good. Never say never again. Yeah. So it's like anything that can help me watching this movie, because I just like watching Connery as Bond.
Right.
It's there. And it's, you know, it makes that movie a lot more fun to watch, and at least you can kind of watch it with fresh eyes and ears if you're going to want to sit through it again.
And how do we find that? We have to go to, like, the McClory site?
Right. We have a link to it.
Oh, that's right, on the website. Bond page. We'll put it on for this show, too.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot. He has a very detailed explanation for any fan editor enthusiasts out there about how he achieved his goals on it, and he has screenshots from his Avid and how he did the Foley noise and redid the music. And I think it's a great experiment, a great example of exactly this fan enthusiasm to take some of these films that, you know, other people might not even care about and trying to give them a new life.
Well, think about this. We were talking about the future a minute ago. Is that in the future, you know, we've already got these new HD DVD Blu-ray discs coming out with this massive amount of space, and you know that's going to grow. You know, and I don't even know if it's going to be on a tangible disc anymore. But, you know, if you're going to fill up something, it's a cube or whatever it's going to turn into, the storage medium, and they say, and it's all about more material. And I think we talked about this before, is who's to say that eventually a special feature won't be all the raw footage? You know?
Oh, exactly.
Here's all the raw footage from this film. Have fun.
Exactly.
You know, if people will buy off on
I mean, wouldn't you love to watch all the alternate takes of Jack Nicholson in The Shining? I mean, takes 1 through 20 that you know are all brilliant.
Right.
They're just different.
Well, you know, and who's to say that that's not some sort of feature in the future that won't be offered? You know, and that's part of the appeal is create your own movie. You know, especially, I mean, as everything comes together into one big unit, you know, your computer, your visual, you know, your stereo system, your home theater system, as it all becomes into one unit, I mean, that would make perfect sense that, you know, on the disc or on the cube or whatever you buy from whatever the store is, that there's not editing software already on there.
You know, yeah, they give it to you for free.
I mean, we've seen it with we did.
They could hold a contest where it's like, we give you the raw footage,
right.
You cut the movie, we're going to hold a contest all day long on MTV. We're going to show 12 versions of the same movie by different editors.
Right.
Do you remember when we were in school, we had that assignment? There was a movie that one of the students made, and it was unedited, and they gave it to all of us to do a cut version of.
Right.
And we all had to reinterpret the same movie.
Uh-huh.
And we all showed them all in class. You remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of experiment. I remember for mine, the movie was so bad, the only thing I could do was score it with wall-to-wall Led Zeppelin.
I think that's the one where they threw the acid on the girl's face, right?
It was a funeral and some ashes, and there was a bar, and the ashes got left behind, and other stuff.
No, I don't remember
that. It was
that.
Horrible. But, you know, it was fun watching all the versions in class.
Right.
Because everybody had the same raw material to work with, which wasn't very good to begin with, but it shows you what you can kind of do as an editor of how you try and at least, you know, make something of it.
Sure.
So I think you're absolutely right, though, in your prediction. I think that's an eventuality.
Well, what's very interesting is that as the medium, well, not as it grows. I mean, it's already huge, but as film grows and things like this are more commonplace and all that kind of stuff, you're going to see a demand for these alternate cuts. And the thing that's just fantastic, and really the thing that spurred this episode, was the new Superman II Donner cut. I mean, that is actually, I mean, it's not a fan edit. It's really a director's cut, but it was demanded by the fans. It wouldn't exist.
It was fan-driven.
Right.
If there was not SupermanCinema.com and a web fan base of Superman 2 fanatics out there
right.
who know the history and know the story and know that footage existed and was sitting in some vault in England. And they organized a campaign a couple years ago where everybody would write in letters and everyone would email Warners on the same day.
Mm.
It was like one massive hit. And they had one big letter. Can you please go back into the vaults and revisit Superman 2 and show us the footage that mm-hmm. we know was already there that we've never been able to see? And it worked. Warner listened. Now, personally, I don't think Warner did it out of any respect for the Superman franchise. I think Warner saw dollar signs and went, if we spend, let's give them $2 million. Let's give them $5 million. But this will be a good way to promote it. We got the Superman Returns movie coming out. We'll just make 2006 the year of Superman.
Right.
And, you know, this will be a great way to bring publicity to the set. And, you know, and of course it pleases the fans along the way. And do you want to give a little background on why we even need a Donner cut?
Well, we probably covered it in DC versus Marvel.
Oh, you're right. We did. So, yeah, go back and listen to that show. It's covered very well.
Right. But I think it's important, like I said, because it's a fan-driven thing. If we can't get our hands on it and you want an official re-edit, you know, maybe if you complain loud enough and make them see that maybe there's some money to be had here, then some official thinking that can, but you know, I don't want Joe Blow down the street to re-edit Superman 2. To me, that's an editing exercise. That's a fart. That's whatever, you know. But when Richard Donner goes back there and redoes it and it's an official thing, that's a whole new thing. That's an official.
It's not really Richard Donner. It's Michael Thal.
Well, yeah.
He's really the one. I don't know if you watched the little featurette.
I did.
Okay. I mean, basically, Thal went through the 6 tons of film. Every single canister, got all the reels, got all the soundtracks logged, and did a reorganizational edit. I'm willing to bet that his first assembly probably included a lot more Richard Lester footage in it to help balance out the pacing and whatnot. And I get the feeling Donner came in, and Donner's contributions were, let's lose that.
Well, it will still be a Donner cut because the final seal of approval has got to go through Donner.
Right.
If it's going to have his name on it.
I'm just saying it's really, and Michael Thal just opened up the screenplay.
Right.
And basically followed the original editorial. I think he had a copy of the work print Stuart Baird put together.
Because
Stuart Baird is credited as an editor on the film.
Right.
Which means Stuart Baird was editing Superman 1 and 2 at the same time.
Right.
If Superman 2 footage came in from the Daily Planet, he didn't, like, set it aside. He said, okay, I'll cut this scene.
Right.
And set it aside. And there was probably at one point where someone put together an assembly of everything they had of Superman 2 at one point.
Right.
And, Thal was able to use that and sort of springboard to create this other version. It's important to note that the original ending of Superman 1 was not Lois dying. She did not die. Superman went and threw the missile up into the sky.
Uh-huh,
okay?
Uh-huh.
The missile tumbles, explodes, and the Phantom Zone villains escape. And then Superman 1 ended with a title card said, like, next year Superman 2.
Right, which would have made perfect sense.
It would have been a cliffhanger ending, okay?
Right.
And then if you think, and then you open Superman 2 up with the Daily Planet, it makes perfect sense.
Right.
It's just literally picking up the moment after Superman threw that missile in the sky.
Right.
You know, and so that's fine. And then the original ending of Superman 2 is Lois died in the Fortress of Solitude.
Right, and then we were going to get the spinning around the Earth.
And so she's dead. The villains are all... He's already, you know, got the powers away from the villains, so he's conquered them, but Lois is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when Superman goes and spins around the world and, you know, resets everything. Interesting to note, though, is he doesn't get to confront his father that way, though, the way he does in Superman the movie, which I think turns out to be one of the better moments, is when he defies his father. And goes and spins around the world after the first movie.
Right.
So I thought using it again in this version was not necessarily the best choice, but I could see why they did it.
Right.
So my feeling was is when I got to that part in the Donner cut of the ending and he spun around the world again, I didn't like it. I really didn't like it, in fact. because it seemed like, is he just going to solve all his problems by spinning the world around over and over again? And if the only reason to do it is to erase Lois's memory, let the girl know. I mean, that would have been the best ending, I think, had Donner stayed on for Superman 2, and they knew they couldn't spin the world around again, and they would not have done that. And I listened on the commentary. They did not reveal what they would have come up with, because I don't think they ever did.
Right.
But the appropriate ending would have been Lois knowing.
Right.
And not revealing his secret, and that being okay. That's the ultimate arc for the relationship, and it would have been fun in Superman 3 with Lois knowing. And even Clark dating Lana and pursuing her. If you did a rewrite of Superman 3, having Lois know that identity would have been a lot of fun.
Well, but let's just face it. Had Lois known, she would have never, you know, continued to treat Clark like that. And they would have been a tight couple. If the trajectory of the relationship stays where it was going toward the end of the Donner cut, before he reversed the Earth, Lana would never have come back into the picture. Because they would have been really tight.
Saying, if they go through a period where they're just friends for a little while,
yeah,
that might be kind of fun with the interplay. And maybe that's just Smallville thinking.
And the point is,
part.
Well, what's to say that if she, and I'm referring to the Donner cut, she figured it out on her own. You know, I mean, what's to say she wouldn't figure it out again? She's a smart girl. She's an investigative.
And she will. So there's no reason to try and erase her memory.
Right.
And I mean,
but let's just say this:
it opens up a paradox, and anytime you mess with time, paradoxes are opened. What I liked about Superman the movie is he didn't go back that far.
Right.
I mean, he literally only went back a few minutes to save Lois's life.
Right. In
Superman 2, he's got to go back a day or two. You know,
it's a long time,
and it's stupid because you know you got Perry White with the toothpaste. And then it cuts to, you know, Washington and then back to Perry. You know, it's just the time continuity is all out of whack if you're really going to,
I think it's a stopgap measure because what you're seeing in Superman II, the Donner cut, it is getting rid of all this stupid shit that Richard Lester put in there that made it so much more comical and silly.
Well, obviously, when they got to the Fortress of Solitude and, you know, one of the conditions for Lester in order to get a director's credit is he had to direct 40% of the movie.
Right.
Now, Donner had shot 80% of the movie already. So Lester had to shoot 20%.
Well, see, and that's
no
where you get
what.
All this corny stuff with the, you know, you can appear and disappear. I'm talking about, I mean.
I know. No, I was going to run down a checklist.
Well, hold on.
You're right. Specifically, when they got to the Fortress of Solitude, they said, we don't have an action beat here. We need something. What can we do to make this scene more interesting? And it was like, okay, well, I think it was just they were making it up on the set that day. Oh, well, Superman can throw this S and it'll turn into a bag or something.
That was terrible.
Okay?
That's one of the things I always hated was that they introduced all these powers that Superman had that we had never heard about in any comic or any incantation.
Now, the invisibility one I didn't have a problem with because he's inside the fortress.
Right.
So there can be some mystical creative uses of reflections and whatnot. Yeah. I never have a problem with the invisibility one. The S one was like, I've never seen him do that before. That would have been handy earlier.
But worst of all is the magic kiss.
Yeah, the magic kiss.
And even though we don't necessarily like the going around the world again, at least it's not the magic stupid kiss. That was the worst.
Well, I think there's even one fan edit that has a close-up of him holding a green kryptonite crystal when he kisses her.
Well, that would make...
That's their way to explain the kiss.
Well, that would make even more sense. But how could he hold a... He couldn't hold a green kryptonite crystal. It would kill him.
No, the one from the fortress.
Crystal. Yeah.
I mean, literally, when you introduce that crystal into a scenario, anything goes.
If he
kisses her holding that crystal, we have to accept
Sure, I would accept that. But that wasn't the case in the official. It was just some magical, stupid kiss.
I mean, I don't know if that's an outtake on the editing floor. I'd suggest cutting it in. I don't know. I read that somewhere. I've never seen it.
But in lieu of that, and I understand how Donner was going back and taking away all the corny stuff, and a lot of those extra powers were part of it. I mean, think about this. This is one thing when we were talking about this on email yesterday. was that one thing I totally even forgot about was all those chirps and stupid sounds that the big guy made.
Right.
All that's gone. Remember how stupid that was?
Well, he couldn't figure out how to use his laser beam. That was the gag.
Well, but no, it's like he always made those stupid sounds. He was like, you know, yeah. And it's like all that's gone. And it's, you know,
one thing I did not like is it's too abbreviated when they get to the town of Houston.
Right.
I felt like that scene needed to breathe. I wanted that scene where they walked in and she arm wrestles the guy and he throws the other guy out the window. The threat needed to be in the film. So, again, the fan edit in me thinks that because of Donner's resistance to use any Lester footage, and I think that if he could have gotten away with it, he wouldn't have used any at all, but he had to do some of it to bridge. Because, you know, let's face it, he didn't get to shoot key things.
Well, I think...
But I think a combination of both cuts could make the ultimate version of Superman 2. And I don't mean you have to put everything that Lester shot back into it. But I think there are certain things that you could still use that are in that cut that'll make Superman 2 breathe a little bit better.
But to me, I always liked Superman 2. I didn't love it. But it was such a corny movie in comparison to the first one. Whereas the first one was you know, it had a grandiose feeling to it. This one felt so corny and actiony, and it was just like, it was like the Jar Jar. I mean, it started the trajectory down of the Superman films. And I think
you had the filmmakers did not believe in Superman. They're a little bit cynical. So their approach is coming at it much like how they treated the Three Musketeers, where that kind of approach is fine. But you don't do that for Superman, because he's already coming from a comic book world.
So you
need to ground him in that kind of reality that Donner gave him.
Well, and the Donner cut brings all that back. It slows it down. I mean, it really felt a lot more like the new Superman Returns film than any of them. And I was like, whoa, you know, just like, did Singer see this or something?
I wouldn't even have minded more courtship scenes inside the fortress. I never minded, like, you know, when he pops the champagne bottle and goes and gets those, what does he go and fly? He flies to some country to get some food for
him. Right, he gets food,
I never minded that.
Here's the bad thing about a fan edit, or this edit in particular, is just that you're comparing it to stuff you already know.
Right, you're used to seeing, because I saw it so many times.
What I'm saying is that if you saw this for the first time, I think that you would get a better view. I know that I really like this Donner edit. Okay?
Oh, yeah. There's no question.
Throw it on the gauntlet now. Is that I really liked it. I like the pacing of it more. Yes, I noticed when things were taken out that weren't there before. But other things I did not miss at all. And there just seemed to be like a lot of this cornball, corny, silly stuff was all gone. It seemed like a more serious version of the film. Much more like the first film. It was like in tandem. And I think it worked like that. Is it the ultimate Superman 2 cut? No. I think, obviously, you know, especially the scene where they have to use the... where Donner insisted that they use...
the screen test.
The screen test. It, you know, yes, that stuff is good for content.
It's a great deleted scene for me to watch.
Yeah, it's great content, but it totally takes you out of the film.
Yeah.
I mean, completely. I understand him wanting to use it, but it basically says... You can't take this seriously as a movie. It's only an exercise.
So I think the thing is we have to point out is this is not designed to be a final cut.
Right.
It's designed to be a work print cut.
Like a reimagining of the... Yeah.
You know, it's an assembly of what they had available and what their intentions were at the time.
Mm-hmm.
If they would have put this together, they would have never released this version.
Right.
They would have gone and Donner would have insisted on shooting, you know, a half dozen more scenes to flesh it out and fix it and all this other stuff.
But this is the
vibe. It would have been a very different movie, but the heart of this, you know, the 80% of this that's in there would have still been there.
The deal is that this is the vibe that Superman 2 was supposed to have.
Well, it had to have Brando. To take Brando out is just, it's insane.
It is.
I mean, they spent more money trying to shoot new scenes around Brando than it probably would have cost just to pay him.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. It just seems silly. The whole father-son thing is so much clearer now.
Yeah.
And the sacrifice, you know, the son becomes the father and all that, just I really liked a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that was what started the fan drive, as everybody knew that was supposed to be there. I mean, even when Superman 2 came out, I remember reading about this in Starlog and going,
why did they do that? Because they didn't ever really tell you why.
Yeah.
He was just like, you know, wasn't in it. But they knew, you knew the scenes were shot.
So let me ask you this before we even go any further. Mm-hmm. Is there a Janssen extended Superman 2 hybrid cut in the works?
In the works. Well, if you want to collaborate on it, if you have some ideas on what you think might help make it the best cut, I will tell you this. I'll call it a Hollywood Saloon cut. That's what we'll call it.
Why don't we just cut Superman 1 and 2 together into one film then?
That's the way to do it, because that way you could really... Although, it would be nice... It's nice. I don't want to take away the Lois, though, flying around the world. It's so good. I really like that ending on Superman 1. I always thought that was kind of... No matter how implausible it is, it's a good dramatic beat.
When they did what?
In the original ending of Superman 1.
Oh, gotcha.
Spinning the world around. I know a lot of people roll their eyes at it, and you know I'm not going to disagree, but dramatically it was a good beat, and I thought it worked in the film. But I will tell you this. If we did attack it, I don't like the way the Donner Cut opens with the choice of the recap, like with Miss Tessmacher and all that.
Oh, no.
It's really clumsy.
Well, you don't need to see it. I mean, if you've just seen part one or you're cutting them both together.
You have to treat it like I just took part one out of the DVD player and I put this one in.
Yeah.
This one needs to just start.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
From the get-go. But, I mean, do you leave in Paris as an action beat to have, or do you take it out?
Well,
because here's the thing. You could still have the missile at the very beginning.
Right.
The missile can free the Phantom Zone villains.
Right.
You could still go back to the Daily Planet and do Lois revealing Superman's scene.
Right.
Then you could go to Paris.
Well, who says you have to show the second bomb from Paris?
Well, no, you still do the bomb, but when Superman lets that bomb go, that's when the Phantom Zone villains notice that one, and it makes them fly towards Earth.
Ah, yeah, that would work.
That could be your tie-in, if your spin, if you will, my super spin. But you could do it if you wanted to leave in Paris. That would be a way that you could incorporate it. And I'm talking about this is Ultimate Fan Edit.
Right.
Because Paris was never intended. But I will say this, for Superman 2 being the big sequel, the follow-up, Superman doesn't do a hell of a lot except go rescue a kid at Niagara Falls for an hour in the movie.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe an hour and a half. I think anything, you know, that we can give him, you know, it depends on how much you like the Paris scene, I guess. Some people find it farcy and not good. But,
well, I think we've gotten used to it, is the issue. Is that, you know, like anything, you get attached to the first cut. I mean, I don't think there's anyone who would agree that, you know, they may, well, maybe somebody, but that they like the Blade Runner theatrical cut better than the director's cut. But, you know, sometimes you get used to that stuff. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, the voiceovers aren't that great, but once you've been seeing them for 15 years or however long, you get used to that.
Yeah.
And when they're gone, it's like, man, something's missing from this. It just doesn't feel right. So I think, I mean...
You could put together a fun hybrid cut, I think.
Well, sure.
That would sort of, you know, address some of those type of things. And it would just be something, you know, like you as a fan would watch. Like, another hybrid cut that I did put together was my Alien 3 hybrid cut.
Right.
And it was mainly because me personally, while I respect the ox, and I love seeing the oxen.
Which is from the director's cut.
Which is from, well, actually not officially director's cut.
The
work print assembly done by Terry Rawlings.
Right.
Without Fincher's participation, but this was the version of the film that they first put together and they screened.
Right.
Before they decided to go in and hack it and make changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it changed to the dog. But I'm so used to the dog. I love the way the dog is shot. I love the way the music is scored to the cuts.
Right.
It's just, I think it's brilliant. So, in a way, I like, and also the physicality of the eventual alien attack seemed to better resemble a dog and the speed of a dog.
Right.
As opposed to the big, bulky, brute force of the oxen, which is probably the original intention.
Right.
But so what I did is I basically took the special edition cut, left it intact, reworked it to where the dog scene is in there, and then added the extra little chest burster at the end, because I really like the beat of music that it hits on, honestly.
Well, see, and that's,
you know, when she's diving off, it's scored a little bit differently in the extended cut, and in a way my ears were so in love with the way it was cut and scored in theatrical that I was starting to miss it when I watched that.
Ultimately, I think that's the problem with director's cuts, is that when you fall in love with certain things in a theatrical cut, and then you get this new you know, refangled edition, and it's there's some things that are taken away that you really liked, then you're at a loss. Then you say, okay, I really liked a lot of things in this new edit, but at the same time, there's some things I didn't like that I liked in the original. You're screwed. So when you want to watch a movie, which version do you watch? You know?
Well, that was the question I had about Alien 3 right. being a favorite movie of both of ours. So I thought, well, okay, I can solve this really easy. I'll go just do my own assembly cut, and that can be a version to watch.
Right.
You know? I'll make a dual-layer DVD out of it so I get really good compression, and boom, you know, I have it. And that wasn't even the first one I had done. I did one for Manhunter, or a.k.a. Red Dragon, the Michael Mann version.
What, you don't like the other guy?
Who?
You don't like the Ratner cut?
I don't like Mick Red Dragon, okay? Mick Dragon. Red Dragon, Manhunter. What I did is I had noticed that the director's cut that finally came out on DVD was missing some things from an earlier director's cut. And he had specifically dropped this line that Grand gave towards the very end of the movie about empathizing with the killer. And in the theatrical cut, I always liked it, and I've missed it ever since. Because he dropped that. And it's only about, you know, 45 seconds worth of material. And there's some other things that he rejiggered, like Graham riding up in an elevator. It's not a big, flashy, showy scene. It's well shot. It's just two simple shots. But I always like the music beat on it, the way it came from the scene before it. Like, it gave that last scene a nice little breath of, you know, out air before it cut to the next scene of him in the hotel watching the videos.
Right.
And I always liked that. And when he cut it out, it's like it's a jarring cut to me now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did is I put together an extended version that had every available thing that I could do. And from the TV broadcast, when Manhunter was broadcast on TV, they broadcast it as Red Dragon.
Right.
And it had the same font as Manhunter, but it was Red Dragon and it was in red. So I stole that and put that as my title card. So it's the Red Dragon Extended Manhunter Cut. But, you know, how long did it take me to edit? Probably about 45 minutes, no longer than an hour, to assemble and put together. Because I knew the film, I knew where the cuts needed to go, and it was like boom, 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 and it was done.
It's just, to me, it's just a shame that, you can't just say, would you like to watch Manhunter tonight? You have to say, well, would you like to watch Manhunter? Would you like to watch the director's
extended
cut?
Extended version or the theatrical version or the director's cut version?
Yeah, or the Jansen version. I mean, which version would you like to see? And it's just like, stop. You know, can't it just be that there's one version of a movie and you like it or not? Now, you know, of course, we can make our fan edits out of anything. You know.
Well, and this is this, you know, and that was what that one was. I mean, I did it for me, and, you know, I give it to anyone that wants
sure.
it, that kind of thing. If they're a fan of it, they're going to like having the extra bits. That's sort of my rule of thumb. If you love Manhunter, you're going to like the extra stuff.
Well, and I'm with you on the Alien 3. I love the chest burster at the end, and I'm used to it. And it will seem awkward to me when I watch it without.
Yeah.
Or it was awkward to me when I watched the new version. And I was like,
you love all the extra stuff in the extended cut.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's hard for me. I mean, I can almost just accept what the theatrical version of Alien 3 is just because it's what I know, it's what I love. I never had a problem with it. You know, it's everyone else who had a damn problem with it. You know, so that the other one exists. I mean, I think it comes down to this, is that with these different versions, including our fan version, it's really what is your official version? You know, and I guess if you're willing to dig in that deep as an editor and re-edit a film to your liking, well, then, damn it, you have a right to make that your official version.
Well, it doesn't have to be official. It can just be the one you watch for a little while, and then one day you're going to go, God, I kind of miss what that version was like, and you'll rewatch it.
I know I do. I like having an official version of a movie. I like saying, okay, this is my official version.
As we said in Final Cut, we're living in an age where that kind of thinking is going to become outdated.
And that sucks, man, because you know what? Like I said, it makes me want to not go to the theaters because, you know, you heard in our summer movie rant how I knocked Miami Vice a new asshole, okay?
I know.
And now, you know, I don't know that I want to suffer through that again to see the changes in the new version. You know, and they did it with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Now they've got a new version of that coming out and a new DVD dip ripoff script. I mean, come on, you know?
Enough already.
I went out for my son, who loves the books and loves the film, and bought him the $30 freaking double disc with all the specials on it. Now they're going to give me a 4-disc set? Fuck you, you know? I mean, it's just like, come on. I mean, how many times do I got to buy this damn movie, you know, to have the definitive edition? And it's just, it's tiring.
Well, and that's, I think, you know, you can also slot it in as, what do I have time for?
Well, sure.
You know, now one movie that I did an extended cut on, and it's a movie that I can say I've seen more than 50 times.
Right.
But it was, this is Spinal Tap.
Now, hold on. Before you jump in there, I'm completely with you on that, because that is the type of film that lends itself to that. You know, I remember back when we were in college, and you went and gathered up all that raw footage of U2 Rattling Hum.
Right.
With, yeah. Something like that, where you're not looking for, I mean, it's all about bits. You know, the Rattle and Hum as a documentary, you know, performance here, stuff with interviews here, that's great. That's gold. You know, you can make a six-hour version or whatever you want of that thing, and it doesn't matter. There's, you're not destroying anything. You're creating just more of what you like. Same with what you're talking about with Spinal Tap, is that that's all about the bits. That's all about the stuff that they didn't use that's still perfectly hilarious.
Oh, and I mean, you know, in the case of Spinal Tap, it started out as there was this mythical 4.5 hour cut that I heard about.
Right.
Okay. And I had heard about it in the 80s. And it was the first cut, basically. Mm-hmm. When they came back and they put everything together, it was before they even shot the interviews. It was just like, okay, we went and shot for 32 days. Let's see what we got, you know, and they put it all together.
Yeah.
And then the masterful editing started. And they got the movie down to about 82 minutes. You know, they added in the interviews to help bridge some things. And they made a classic movie. You know, sure. It's the right running time. It's brief and it moves along. But you would hear rumors, you know, about this longer cut. Well, when Criterion put out their first Laserdisc for Tap, they included 50 minutes of outtakes.
Jeez.
Of deleted scenes. And, you know, it gave everyone a kind of a peek into some of them. And most of them were subplots, a la James Cameron, just all these alternate subplots that were carrying on. And then I finally got my hands on the 4.5 hour cut and was able to see the entire intention of the movie. And then when the MGM DVD came out for that DVD release, not only did it have the commentary with the band and character, but it had about 30 minutes of deleted scenes that were not on the Criterion.
Uh-huh.
So what I got the idea is like, okay, I got about 80 minutes of deleted scenes over here, and the movie's 80 minutes. What if I put it all together and made a 160-minute version of the movie? It turned out to be about 167 minutes, because what I did was when they cut to the song on television of them playing, like, Give Me Some Money. Well, in the theatrical version, you hear about the first minute of it, and then it cuts away.
Yeah.
Well, I just got the video and played the whole song out.
Right.
And then it cuts back. So you get two full extended songs from Give Me Some Money and Flower People. Plus, I went back and followed the original structure and just added back in all the bits and pieces that were in the deleted scenes. And a lot of them are perfectly good and very funny. But you can't beat the flow of 82 minutes for a documentary. It's just, you know, right. It's just right. But for fans of Tap that watch the 82-minute version and then they go to the deleted scenes and watch them all in a row, wouldn't it be better if you could just watch it all in context?
Sure.
Instead of just watching the deleted scenes? That was my theory.
Yeah.
So that's what the assembly came about, and I ended up making a 3-hour cut of Tap.
Right.
And putting it together in that kind of way. And, you know, it's not designed to replace the film. I mean, you can't replace genius like that.
Right.
But it's an alternate fun cut just for fans of the movie that have seen it so many times that would like to be surprised about a cut. Oh, whoa, I didn't expect that, you know?
Right.
And you only get that really once or twice with a fan edit, and then you get used to the fan edit, and it's not new to you anymore.
Sure.
But is there a way to make a favorite movie of yours new again? And that's sort of the challenge of the fan edit. It's a challenge I like taking on, frankly.
Well, and I think if sometimes... See, and the thing that's funny that I've been asking myself during this whole thing is, does a movie have to be considered poor to do a fan edit? And obviously with Spinal Tap, you've shown that that's not the case.
Oh,
you know,
no.
That's you know, now granted, you're adding. You're not detracting, okay?
Oh, no, no. There's not one thing cut.
Right. So, see, that's the deal, is that's just about adding deleted scenes in. Whereas, you know, can you take a movie that's considered good and by deleting make it great? And that's,
oh, right.
I mean, that's the question. I'm sure there's something out there that would possibly be that, you know, but finding that would be a difficult thing. I think the fan in the fan edit, meaning us, You know, we want to see certain things come to be. And I know one of your notes, questions you had put on the notes, which really excited me, was future fan edits. Like, what do you want to see? What movies would you like to see, you know, redone? Which ones would you like to rework? And I know, and back to the thing that got the Donner Cut created, was that there was a little bit of an uprising back with Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, to let Shatner go back in there and rebuild his vision for The Final Frontier. Everyone knows that, you know, that's the turkey of the series.
Well, and they allowed it to happen for the motion picture, so it gave fans hope.
Right.
That Paramount, ooh, well, maybe they'll let Shatner fix Five.
Right. Because I've read his behind-the-scenes book on the making of Final Frontier, and believe me, the vision is much grander and much bigger than what we got. And, I mean, I think it goes to such a legendary status that think of a movie of think of Galaxy Quest, is that, you know, in his desire to get his rock people created, you know, they always talked about his rock
right.
man, is that they played that out in Galaxy Quest, and it had to be a tip of the hat to that situation because, you know, he had originally, you know, said, oh, I want to have six rock guys or something like that, and they gave him one really shitty suit that they had to just cut out altogether. You know, and you know, obviously the makers of Galaxy Quest realized that, and then as a tip of the hat to Shatner, which, I mean, the whole movie is a tip of the hat and a love letter to the people who make Star Trek.
Sure.
Finally gave him, you know, that rock scene. But what a cool fan edit to see, whether or not, you know, Shatner can actually, you know, save the film and make it better than it is. I mean, certainly there's moments in it that are wonderful, but, you know, for the most part, most, you know, fans agree, it's the weakest one. Had he been able to get closer to his vision and had the budget, you know, which didn't make sense because Star Trek IV, you know, I mean, was the biggest Star Trek of them all, and then they just gutted his budget when he went to making Five.
Right.
And
another Five that you could re-edit would be Rocky Five.
Oh, man.
But I don't know if you could save it or not.
No, I think you could make a really good, probably one-hour film.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of turkey in that movie, but there's a lot of good stuff too. And I can only say that because I've just recently watched it again, like a couple days ago. And I can tell you that there's some scenes that I think are great and that are perfect for the Rocky arc. And you know what? It's perfect that Rocky went that direction to train somebody. That makes total sense.
It's the right arc for his character at the time.
Right. But we'll,
it was the right script, but the wrong execution.
Right. And we'll talk about that on the Rocky show. You know.
But one of the other fan edits I did put together that falls into your category for a film that I think is perfect, and this is a film I admire a great deal.
Right.
It's one of my list of perfect movies is Dazed to Confused. Mm-hmm. And I even hinted at it in the final cut when the Criterion Edition came out. It had, you know, a lot of deleted scenes. And I actually have a copy of the work print of Dazed, which is a little bit different, too. It's extended, has some alternate takes and alternate music. But the deleted scenes that were on the Criterion disc were not even in this work print.
Right.
So what I decided to do was break out the script of Dazed and make the longest possible cut with all the available footage I had. And so that's what I put together. And, you know, I was able to add, you know, almost a good 21 minutes to the movie.
Wow.
And it's just subplots and extra scenes with the characters. So if you love that movie like I do, then it's just a way of watching an even longer version of it.
Right.
And, you know, just if you're familiar with it, it's kind of interesting to see the extra character beats and some of the motivations. And I don't know if it's going to change the way you look at it, but it's going to make you look at it differently from a new angle. There's like a whole subplot with the statues they steal that's now very clear that you can see what its intention was. And what the challenge was is the deleted scenes were not scored with music. So what I had to do was, is once I put the deleted scene back in where it belonged, I had to pick up where that scene left off with the music cue, go find that song, find that exact moment,
right,
and let it continue over my deleted scene at the same level. So, you know, it was a little challenge in there to try and make it all work.
Right.
So, again, the editor in me had fun doing it, but I do give myself a limit. It's like, okay, I'm going to work on this for like one night. And I'm going to put all this together. This is not going to be like a 4-week affair or something, you know?
Yeah.
I give myself like a little limit. It's like, okay, that's what you have to work on. It. Other than that, then you're just, you know, jerking off.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, I mean, ultimately, really, I mean, that's, you know, for the most part, what the fan edit is really about is just jerking off, just having fun, learning how to cut, learning how to edit. I mean, and just taking what you think is good and tailoring it to your taste, which I think is perfectly permissible. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, sure, you come across the thing as, what is art? You know, are you damaging art? Are you messing with art? It's like, well, okay, if you're going to take this and brag about it and say, this is the best cut possible, well, that's a different story. But if you're just experimenting, man, knock yourself out. And I can't imagine any director that would be opposed to that either. You know, unless, like I said, someone comes out and says, oh, this is a better version, this is the official version.
I even made sure I put a disclaimer on my Dazed and Confused. It's like, you know, a whole written example of what it is and how it was created.
Right.
And I specifically state, this is not intended to replace the theatrical cut. You know,
right.
At all. It's just meant to be an expanded, fun cut for people that know the movie and love it and want to spend more time with their favorite characters.
And that's fine. To me, the only official version of any film will be from the director's hands and whatever his final director's cut is. But if, you know...
Now, and I'm not arrogant enough to think, well, they should have hired me to edit the movie. I've never edited a professional feature film that has to go through all the processes that goes through. I mean, I've done my own projects, but through the process of studying these other directors' films and going through them, I know I'm a better editor than I was beforehand. And for me, that's what makes them worthwhile. If I didn't feel like I was getting anything out of it, then I wouldn't do it.
Well, and
ultimately,
that's,
then it would just be frivolous.
Well, and that's why it's called the fan edit. You know, I mean, you can't do more with it really than that. It's something for your edification. However, the exciting thing is that it's not just you alone anymore. It's everywhere. We're seeing it with Never Say Never Again or Never Say McClory Again.
Well, and the YouTube explosion is only going to provide an outlet for these type of films.
Well, it's only getting around the...
And I think anyone that's really net savvy out there, if they want it, they know how to find it.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's, you know, this whole world of, you know, LimeWire and all the other ways you can get stuff beyond just the web.
I mean, there's so many training networks and groups and things. And
sure. I mean, there's ways to get it. But I think ultimately the fan edit is a good thing. I think it's for your edification. I think that, like I said, the fact that it's blowing up and you're going to see these things, I think the fun part, part of the fun is showing your work and saying, well, what do you think about this? And trading, well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about this?
Oh, see, that's part of my... This will sound pretentious and stupid, but part of my ethics behind it is they can never be sold. They have to be traded.
Well,
it's made by fans for fans.
Right.
Because that's sort of the bootleg ethic.
Right.
Like if you're a fan of Floyd or Zeppelin or the Beatles, you know, and traded freely, or the Grateful Dead or Pearl Jam or any of those, fans always traded freely with other fans.
Right.
They didn't charge them and jack them and try and profit off of what they love.
Yeah.
They just wanted to spread it out more, if you will, make more awareness to it.
Well, let me ask
and
you
so
this.
So that's sort of my philosophy is silly, hippy-dippy, dopey that sounds.
No, I mean, I think that completely makes sense. Well, let me tell you this, and not that anyone gives a flying rip about the Hollywood Saloon in comparison to a film, but let's just say, you know, I don't know, a year from now, the Hollywood Saloon Tony Scott special edit, fan edit comes out, and they've trimmed stuff that of us saying, you know, 1,000 times. Mm-hmm.
Added some music.
They added music because that's the bald episode, I like to call it. That was before I scored our entire episodes basically with music. And it's always kind of been a pain in my side because every time if I try to listen to it, I'm like, God, there should be music there. There should be music there. Mm-hmm. And there's not. You know, someone could easily take that, rescore it, trim out the crap that they didn't like us saying, and have a really tight, maybe, you know, shorter episode. You know, I mean, how would that make us feel? I mean, I would probably feel very strange saying, okay, what gives them the right to steal my thoughts away, to steal my ideas away?
Well, I guess it would be like you're a songwriter, you wrote a song, but the radio says we need a radio edit.
Right.
You don't do it yourself. Someone else does it. You probably approve it. Maybe you don't even get a chance to.
Well,
the
see, that's what I'm saying.
The record company does the edit.
When it's a
but
fan edit.
But it's just
edit.
Meant to fit a gap. So if someone recut our Tony Scott episode and it's like, well, your show's an hour and a half, and I need it to be an hour. So I cut 30 minutes out of it so it could fit in this block. I'd say, well, let's see how you did it. Because you brought up a good point. You asked me this once. How would you feel if someone recut Mainly Etc., my film?
Right.
And honestly, my first instinct is I would love to watch it. Because if I could learn something new about my own movie, I'd be very surprised. And I would love to learn something new about something that, you know, I had a hand in on every single decision made, at least technically, in the editing and the photographing and so forth.
Right.
So for me, for a film that I had lived with and had seen 100 times and that I don't even have a desire to watch again, if someone had a re-edit of it, I could watch my movie new in a way that I would never know what the next cut is or know what the next choice is.
Right.
I don't know if I'm going to love it, but I think personally I might get a kick out of looking at what this remix was like and seeing what somebody else thought of the way it should have gone.
Well, they totally.
And to see if I agree, because maybe they're going to see something I don't, because they're coming at it from a different perspective. I'm too insular. You know, you live through the production, you live through the editing,
yeah,
and you
but
make
see,
choices.
What a hassle that is, because, I mean, here's what I would think, is I would say, go make your own film. Don't recut it. Don't recut mine.
And that would be my next thing. It's like, after the experiment of recutting mine, now you should go cut one too. And then you send it to me and I'll re-edit yours and tell you what I think, you know?
Yeah.
And play it back and forth that way.
Well, but
no, I agree.
I mean, as an editing exercise, that's one thing. But I think the thing ultimately, I mean, you're being very humble when you say those things that you say. I mean, if I spent my ass working on a film, you know, 3 or 4 years, and then someone has the gall to get in there and recut it and then send it to me and say,
it doesn't mean that I accept it.
No, hold on. And they send it to you and they say, hey, here's some changes I think you ought to take a look at. You'd be like, to hell with you, man. I don't want to listen to what you have to say. This is what I intended this film to be. And if you don't like it, keep your little fan edit to yourself.
You're right. You know what? I would have had probably that exact reaction during the making of it, maybe a year later.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get like 5 years removed or so from a movie you made, it's almost like, huh, what? Oh, okay.
Well,
what
if I took it and rescored it with techno music?
See, that would be interesting to me. I would watch it. And I knew it wouldn't replace the original.
Right.
And so as long as, you know, the original's out there, I guess I don't care. Now, I might feel differently about my Pink Floyd The Wall film just because every single cut in there I scrutinized over. So, I mean, there's not really any changes I want to make to that one.
Right.
You know, I'd be curious to see what someone else's interpretation would be. Because that's what all it turns into, is just your own individual taste.
Well, I mean, really, isn't your Pink Floyd movie just a fan edit? Reworking editing project
anyway.
It's
a complete fan film for Pink Floyd The Wall.
Right.
To the point to where I rewrote an entire script based on, I adapted it is what it is.
Yeah.
It was for a pro production. I mean, it was, you know, staged in San Francisco. So, I mean, at least it was for a paying audience, if you will.
Sure.
So my idea was to update the concept from World War II to Vietnam. Or I didn't want to be involved. Originally, they just wanted to show clips from, like, the original movie and stuff. And I told them, no, don't do that. Don't have any association with Alan Parker's brilliant film, genius.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that. Don't come in with what people are familiar with, because the way you're approaching it and playing it is raw and rugged. So should your visual approach. And I sold them on the Vietnam idea and sold them on the concept of a visual sort of wall-to-wall tapestry of like flipping stations on a television. You'd start in 62 with the rise of the Berlin Wall and travel all the way through 89 with the wall coming down. That would be the bookends for the show. Metaphorically, it worked out perfectly. So now we got to watch our young character grow up in the 60s and get influenced by all that music, specifically Pete Townshend breaking his guitar. So later on in the hotel room, when he smashes his guitar, we have a reference for it.
Right.
You know, from his youth. That's the ideas I was playing with. I mean, the same story, but just filtered through, you know, a new decade or a couple of decades. And then I got to choose visuals, and I went out and shot about 40% of new footage, 45% of new scenes. And then I used archive footage to fill in the rest.
Right. And so that's a combination of an edit project and a film itself.
Right. It's,
which makes it a film. Eventually, all together, you know, just with a similar reference point of something
but,
else.
You know, it's completely done from a fan admirer. I mean, You know, I knew I wasn't going to get rich off of it.
Well, of course, yeah.
You know, it was going to cost me more to make the movie than I would ever see from it, but that wasn't the point.
Right.
It was like I accepted the challenge. And, you know, I guess in those late nights of editing, you have to get a certain level of self-confidence, maybe even arrogance for a moment, to think that you can do it, that I'm tackling something that I admire and respect so much, you know. How dare I think that I could, you know, make a film after Alan Parker made it. But once you free yourself of that, it's like, I'm not going to do what Parker did. I'm going to completely go and do my thing, you know. And Pink Floyd fans may hate it. They may love it. But at least they'll get a chance to see the wall new with fresh eyes.
And the point is that you got to experiment with something that has a reference point.
Afterwards, there's no question about it.
And that's really what we're talking about here is we're talking about this fan edit, and I mean,
and I know this show might sound a little self-serving. It's like all these edits I've done and so forth. I guess we just finally hit upon a subject where I'm like part of the fringe crowd.
Well, I think that it's just a reference point we can relate to because there's not a ton of these things flying around. I mean, that you can just grab onto. I think that it's a growing idea. I think that it's a growing thing that as more and more people have access to editing, you will see these kind of experiments going on. Like I said, the majority of them are right now, they're on YouTube, and they're about three or four minutes long, where mm-hmm. people just drop a music video in, or they drop music in, and they, you know, they recut. I mean, I saw something the other day that was actually a very interesting experiment. It was more audio than it was visual, but they took two separate songs. It was more like a mix, and they mixed them together. It was like a Gwen Stefani song and a Madonna song, and they mixed them together, and they came together perfectly. And for a visual, they just recut the video.
I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it, like I said, it was better audio. The visuals were, you know, there was drop frames, and, you know, when you go to a cut and there's one frame of the shot previously before in there and that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, just junk, you know, not really tight editing. But I think the idea is the same. You know, it's fans getting in there and saying, let's experiment. Let's try something mm-hmm. new. And sure, the RIAA and the MPAA hate all that crap because they're not making their cut. But, you know, if you're going to give us this equipment, like we said a million times before, we're going to work with it. We're creative people.
Well, hey, and to be fair, I did purchase these movies. I did purchase these soundtracks. I paid for all the materials I'm using to make these little art. It's like I went out and bought all the paint and all the canvas. I didn't steal any of this stuff.
Well, and I think
I paid for my materials and then I created my artwork out of it.
Well,
they made money off of me so I could go create this piece of art.
Well, most people wouldn't have problems with you creating and experimenting. It's the selling of. It's the you profit where they can't profit the problem. And I think that's the difference.
Well, and, you know, yeah, as I said earlier, I just coming from the bootlegging, you know, sort of culture and trading and so forth.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was so cool. The first time someone gave me a free bootleg of something I really wanted, which was some Tangerine Dream shows, I thought that was the coolest gift in the world. And I thought, how can I be that cool to somebody else?
Well, it's something that's not official. And when you can get more. When you can get different, that's quite an accomplishment, you know. I mean, most people are just used to their, you know, the $5.99 DVD that comes out now. It's like, this was the version that came out initially of this film, and that's all you need. You know, when you learn that there's other things. And, I mean, how many people really take their DVDs and trade up? I know I'm a trade-up person. I know probably a lot of people listen to our show are trade-up people. You know, if you just had the film-only edition with one trailer on it, when the two-disc special edition comes out loaded with extras, you know, if it's a film you love enough, you're going to trade up. And, you know, who wouldn't want more? I mean, you know, I think the basic idea is more is better. I mean, not always when it comes to actual fan edits, whereas like the Phantom Redo was just, you know, mostly, like I said, like a deletion. We were taking out all the Jar Jar corny cornball stuff. I
mean, wouldn't it be fun if you could go to a Phantom Edit Redo festival and you could spend, two or three days watching the Phantom Menace over and over and getting different interpretations?
I think I'd get sick of it.
Oh, everyone would be, you know, but it would be kind of fun, the culture of it, you know. I mean, I think ultimately a lot of people would probably be making the same choices.
I mean, it's pretty simple. The reason that Phantom Menace got targeted for for fan edits is for Jar Jar Binks, because it, you know,
he's a big one. I do think though that it's not only him; it's a lot of poor line readings from different cast of characters.
Well, it's Jake Lloyd. It's
odd pacing and beats and times that just feel right. awkward. You know.
Well, I'm surprised
and restructuring of scenes specifically. That's what I think the biggest contribution I had, the most radical idea I had, was the rejiggering of the final battle.
Well, see, I know that you're not in love with Attack of the Clones either. Why haven't we seen a Phantom redo Jansen edit of that yet?
You know, it's really funny. I started it and just got frustrated after, like, the first 10 minutes. It's like, I can't do anything with this movie.
Oh.
So I gave up.
Hater.
I just finally said, you know what? I'm just going to let that version be what it is. I'm not going to touch it, you know? But I felt like I had a goal that I wanted to try and achieve with the Phantom Edit redo. And I felt like, for the most part, I got there. Or at least I hit in the 90s. And like I said, it was the restructuring and the final battle to see if it would work. It was like I had a theory. It's like, well, what if you did this? Maybe that might solve what you were talking about, the emotional problem. And as you notice with Jar Jar, what I did was, is, you know, when he jumps on that robot and then he gets stuck on his leg and he like jangles, I just cut all that slapstick part out. Now he looks tough because he's just jumping on that robot.
Yeah, it worked perfectly.
When he hops up on that thing, instead of him juggling that little ball all around, I cut it to an alley-oop.
Well, what's
he tosses
the, whole...
the Jar Jar, and Jar Jar blows up the thing.
Well, yeah, what was the whole point? Why do we have to have, you know, what? Me don't have a Boomba. It's like, please.
It's just, it's one beat too, it's one, so many notes too many.
Yeah.
You peel back some notes, and it's like, man, this is a good piece of music. It can work, you know, and Jar Jar, not me give up, and all that, you know, and just... make him, you cut some Jar Jar lines and he's okay. He's watchable.
Well, but, I'm going to be interested to see in the future how much this takes off. And
well,
if,
let me ask you, would there be what would be your fan edit? Which are some you would like to see an extended cut?
Like I said, I would like to see that Star Trek V, but that's going to be new footage. That's going to have to be an official thing. This is nothing I could recut.
Right.
Me, myself, gosh. It's hard to say. I mean, I think, Rocky V, I think I could, you know, take a lot of stuff out of there that is just moronic, that doesn't need to be.
You could probably combine Rocky IV and V into one movie, couldn't
you?
Yeah,
you probably could. I mean...
one long movie.
But other than that, I mean, either... I'm kind of like... either I like a movie or I don't like a movie. And I don't know that I really watch movies to improve them. And say, well, if you took this out here and took that out there, I know that Star Wars has always been that way to me, because, you know, with the new films, it's almost like you have to say, okay, I liked 85% of this, and the rest I didn't like.
You could argue for a New Hope edit that has all the stuff you like in it and all the new stuff you like.
Oh, right, sure.
You know,
definitely. We don't need all that. You know, that stuff at Mos Eisley, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I would go with the original one there. That'd be fine.
Yeah, and of course, you know.
But the final battle with all that, that would be fine.
No, let it be. So I think Star Wars is a good example. I think it's just because people love Star Wars so much, and they want to have that perfect viewing. They want to have the viewing with the new effects, like, at the end, but they also want, you know, Han Solo to shoot first, for God's sakes.
Well, I remember that DVD that came out with the soundtrack for Sith. And it was just all those music videos of the music, and just watching Star Wars clips over the music.
Mm-hmm.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, that came
out. It makes those early prequel movies look fantastic when you just watch them in montage form like that.
Yeah, that came out with the soundtrack, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, that to me was exciting, and I like those kind of things. And I'd rather put on that than Phantom Menace sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
Or Clones. I can just watch them that way, and I get the best stuff.
Yeah.
And I hear the music, you know, it's the best of both worlds. But so in a way, that's, you know, I guess it's just, you got to watch a movie a certain amount of times, and then it's like, well, what else is there, you know?
Right.
And when you reach that point, I think that might be, it's almost like, you know, that's when you're ready for the fan edit, I guess, you know? When you reach that certain stage where you've seen a film so many times, you know it in and out, you know when the next cut's going to happen. That at least you can get surprised. Maybe a little.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up this episode of the Hollywood Saloon. I just want to invite everyone over to our website at www.hollywoodsaloon.com. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so at hollywoodsaloon@yahoo.com. I just wanted to mention something. We've got a new button on our front page at the Hollywood Saloon. It's our PayPal button. And yes, we have finally given in. And we're just asking that if you feel like we've given you anything in the past by our episodes, by our podcast, then if you feel so moved to do so, we'd love for you to hit us with a donation on that PayPal button. You know, there's certain costs that we incur by doing the show. And it's just gotten more difficult and difficult to take care of those on our own. And if you, and like I said, a little bit here helps, a little bit there helps. If you want to give, you know, $5 here, or if you want to give $500, if you want to give $5,000, what I'm just saying is that every little bit matters, every little bit helps, and it helps us build toward a bigger and a better saloon for the future. We can buy new equipment. You know, I think the possibilities just open wide with the more capital we have to invest back into the saloon so that we can make it better for you guys. So I'm just going to drop that out there. I hope I don't sound like a preacher asking for your money. But praise God, today we got that PayPal button on the front page of the Hollywood Saloon. And like I said, if you would like to support us, we would love for you to do that. If not, no big deal. You're always welcome to continue to download and listen to the saloon with us. I also wanted to say that we recently went through a transfer of our forums, our discussion forums. You know, we were at one specific server for, you know, I don't know, a year and a half. And the quality just went downhill, and it was load times were taking just forever. It was like you were on a dial-up modem or something. It was just really, really slow. And, you know, I didn't want to do it, and I put it off for a long time. But we finally made the move to a new server, and boy, the discussion forum is back up. It's hopping. It's easier to access. A lot of discussion going on there now, more than in a long time. And I think it's because of that changeover. There's not the problems anymore. You go to post something and boom, it's fast. Everything's moving good. Plus, we had the addition of a game arcade where, you know, whoever gets the highest score goes to the top of the charts in the forums. So it's really fun. You know, you've got your different version of old arcade games. You know, like there's a version of Asteroids, there's a version of Space Invaders, there's all these different little mini games, and you know, they're really cheesy, but they're fun, and I think that the fun thing is that we can all compete, and someone's got to come in and save us from Jack's smirking revenge, because he is just totally taking down the board, and I know that the kid reviewer is always on his tail to try to bring him down, but there's a constant battle going on there, and I know there's a few other guys that are trying to vie for top spots on that board, but man, Jack's just trying to take it all over. But anyways, there you go. Our new discussion forums. Come sign up, get into our community where we get deeper into all this stuff. I also wanted to mention that on our special edition page right now at www.hollywoodsaloon.com/se.html, which, again, you can find it off the front page at special edition. We put out a new show called Alias Endgame. And what that is that's really only for Alias fans if you've kind of seen the series all the way through. It's very spoilerific. It's just full of spoilers. And as you know, John and I have been big fans of Alias for the last few years. And so we kind of all wrap it up and discuss how the whole show came to an end, because it obviously just got released fairly recently on DVD, so John had his chance to go through and see it. Now, let me tell you, it's a fun discussion because it's the first time we wildly disagree, and so we get a little rough with each other. So I know some people just want to hear he and I go, you know, fight each other, so that's the place to do it. But if you don't want Alias ruined for you, don't go there. Anyways, that's it for now. Thank you guys for listening, and we hope to continue to get out shows faster and faster here in 2007. So anyways, thank you guys a lot. Thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.
Something's wrong with that. What'd you do exactly?
Well, first we cut Kennedy going down the line. Remember when he asked everybody if they have the code?
Yeah, that's good. But where's the guy who says he has the code?
Okay, watch. He's here.
Well, the line I'm worried about. Kennedy's line following him.
Well, wait. See? There's the guy. Now we just have a reaction shot. We've eliminated his line.
What about Kennedy's line?
What?
You know nothing.
Well, no, he can't say that now. The guy doesn't say anything.
I love that line.
No. Look.
I love that line.
I know, but look, I did a lot of...
I love that line.
I did a lot of thinking here. Listen, please, one second. We find out in an hour from now that these two people are the people involved, okay? That guy knows the code. Kennedy knows he has the code. Why introduce it now? Why not have a little mystery going?
It's not a mystery. It's a space picture.
Yes, I know, but it's just...
It's his character in that.
But I just think...
You know nothing.
No, I swear I think it's wrong this way. This way, the audience can see a little shot of this guy.
That little shot, too. Look at his eyes move. Ooh, something's going to happen here. I'm not crazy about that.
Well, but that's exactly what you want, is something's going
to
happen here.
Not that way. I'd like to do it a little subtler.
Well, I don't think we have any other takes on it.
No, so let's do it all the way out. Let's have him say, I think I have the code, and Kennedy says, you know nothing.
You're going to tip it. You're going
to
tip it.
Better that than to do this little mysterioso.
No, I totally disagree. Now, look, here's what I'm saying. I mean, if you're in a theater and you're watching and the beginning of a movie happens and a character right in the beginning of a movie says, I did it, and the guy in charge says, no, you didn't, well, they've already had that confrontation. Even though he says, no, you didn't, whatever that means, he's already met them. This way, there is no confrontation until an hour later, yet the audience sees it and Kennedy doesn't. That way, what, the audience will go, ah, maybe, or maybe they'll know, maybe they won't know, but I think it works better.
You may be right. But let's do it the other way.
All right. We'll do it the other way.
Okay.
Okay.
You're listening to The Hollywood Saloon.